when we were doing the research for Parallel Lives, we got to a point where we came to find out that the Lizzie Borden that history had handed us was a fictional character, pretty much all the way around. Every time we thought there was something that we knew was true about Lizzie Borden, we'd find several things to dispel the point that she was not at all the person that Lizzie Borden was before Parallel Lives.
Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 10. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is a Nine Muses Books production. This is the only podcast devoted to Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders of 1892. Episode 10, Parallel Lives. Welcome to a special episode of the Lizzie Borden Podcast. Today we will be talking with the Fall River Historical Society curators, Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett, who will discuss the story behind their phenomenal book, Parallel Lives, A Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River, published by the Fall River Historical Society in 2011. First, a few announcements. Nine Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Podcast are proud to present the premiere of The Agitated Elocutionist, a radio play featuring Lizzie Borden Girl Detective, the fictional Lizzie Borden created by author Richard Behrens, yours truly. This radio play should be available at the beginning of March and will premiere on the Lizzie Borden Podcast. Visit LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com for updates about this exciting project. Also, Nine Muses Books is preparing a second volume in the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. The Audible Amnesiac and other Lizzie Borden Girl Detective mysteries will be published this spring by Nine Muses Books. Anyone curious about Lizzie Borden's alternative reality twin, the Girl Detective of Fall River, will not be disappointed with The Audible Amnesiac. It is full of quirky humor and also an intriguing mystery. Now back to the episode. The Fall River Historical Society is located at 451 Rock Street in Fall River, Massachusetts. Information about the Society can be found on their Facebook page or on their website, lizzieborden.org. They are a public charity organization charged with collecting and archiving historical artifacts and materials related to the multicultural history and heritage of the city of Fall River. A part of that mission is to preserve and protect the legacy of the Borden family, Lizzie Borden, and the historical impact of the Borden murders of 1892. Their Lizzie Borden exhibit includes rare photographs, crime scene artifacts, and personal items that belong to the Bordens. They also have a research library with a large collection of primary source material on both the Borden tragedy and Fall River history. The Fall River Historical Society should be a part of any historically minded tourist visit to the city. Parallel Lives, A Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River, is a groundbreaking work and arguably the only professional biography of Lizzie Borden. Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett worked on this book for approximately 10 years, tracking down material related to Lizzie and the Borden family, cultivating relationships with owners of private collections and descendants of those who knew Lizzie. Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett pieced together a vast puzzle, a portrait of Lizzie Borden, Fall River's most notorious resident and historical mystery. The book is filled with one revelation after another. It opens a window onto Lizzie Borden's childhood through the diaries and letters of her friends. The details of her 1890 European tour are revealed through Lizzie's personal scrapbooks, filled with hundreds of postcards and annotations. Because of this book, we can now read her prison letters and gain profound insight into her private thoughts during the long ordeal of her incarceration and trial. New revelations about Lizzie's Maplecroft years, including light shed on her relationship with actress Nance O'Neill, her sister Emma, and a small but loyal group of servants and friends who maintained their silence about Lizzie for decades. And then there are the new photographs of Lizzie, published in this book for the very first time, from the private collections of families that knew her best and had gained her trust. Most of all, Parallel Lives teaches us all we need to know about Fall River society during Lizzie's lifetime, so we could put her tragic life into historical and cultural context. The book has as much material about Fall River's golden age, when cotton was king, as it does about Lizzie Borden, and the entire story is held in a delicate balance, where the social fabric of the city helps us understand Lizzie on a much deeper level. Parallel Lives received a starred review from Kirkus Review, one of publishing's highest honors, and Kirkus declared it one of the best books of that year. It is certainly one of the best books for a hardcore Lizzie Borden enthusiast. Here to help us gain some insight into Parallel Lives are the co-authors and curators of the Fall River Historical Society, Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett. Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast.
Thank you. Good morning, Richard.
Michael, do you want to start? Just tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to the Historical Society.
Well, I'm Michael Martins. I'm the curator of the Historical Society, and I've been here for quite a few years, and fortunately, early on, had the opportunity to get to know a number of people who either personally or through their families had close connections to either Lizzie or the Borden case. So it provided me with sort of perhaps a different insight into her life and what might have happened in 1892.
You started at a time when a lot of the generation that would have known her in the 20s were still around.
Yes, I was quite young when I started here. So, you know, at the time, many of the people that I knew were, you know, well into their 80s and 90s, and I did get to know some of them really quite well. So it gave me a different perspective, because Lizzie Borden became that much more real to me. So I think I saw her more as a person than a legend. And I think that it did help when we decided to take on Parallel Lives.
And I think that probably gave you a very unique perspective as a co-author of the book.
Probably it did. And it also furnished a few leads that we might not have otherwise had into finding material in private collections.
So, Dennis, you're the assistant curator of the Historical Society?
Yes. I came here as a volunteer when I was on board 24 years ago, and I'm like the man who came to dinner. It's interesting because actually my field was English literature, and I never worked in my field. After I got out of college, I was always in finance, which was probably my worst subject when I was going through school. So it's ironic that I finally ended up here and ended up working on not just Parallel Lives, but also the Knowlton Papers, the first book that Michael and I did.
Michael predates you at the Historical Society by several years.
Yes, he does.
So, Michael, you must have started when you were a teenager.
Oh, I was a kid. I started doing tours here when I was, well, I met Florence Brigham when I was not quite 14, so I go back quite a few years. It's funny when I think of it now. I mean, at the time, many of the people that I knew, some of the people who became some of my closest friends, were at the end of their lives when I was sort of the beginning of mine. So it was sort of an interesting dynamic at the time. And then, you know, when we worked on Parallel Lives, it all sort of came together, so that was a good thing.
So you mentioned Florence. Could you tell us something about her?
No, Florence Brigham certainly my greatest friend and without doubt my mentor, a phenomenal lady. And she was without doubt the city's greatest historian. She knew Fall River history because she lived it. She was a very private individual and had a very close connection to the Borden case, in that her mother-in-law, Mary Ellis Jean Brigham, was a very close friend of Lizzie and Emma Borden's, one of the first people to arrive on the scene the day of the murders, and was very active in the trial and very close to the Borden sisters. Mrs. Brigham never discussed it much, and it was interesting because she absolutely abhorred the subject. I mean, she couldn't stand the topic. Lizzie Borden did not interest her in the least, and she feigned interest, which she had to do by virtue of her position here at the Historical Society, but she said very little of what she knew. She only said as much as she had to, and, you know, it always cracks me up because people will say that, you know, they were very close to Florence Brigham, and they, you know, she told them so much about the Borden case, and I have to laugh. I know full well how little she actually told them and how little it actually interested her. Her husband, as a child, used to visit the Borden sisters, Lizzie and Emma, and would recite poetry to them. And he remembered them particularly as two nice old ladies who used to give him cookies. So she had a very close connection.
Well, how far back does the Fall River Historical Society go? When was it founded?
1921. Founded in 21. Initially, there was an attempt in 1918, and it was sort of a club. It was never terribly successful. They officially incorporated in 1921 and began collecting. The first major Borden collection that came into the Society's collection would be the Hip Bath, the so-called Hip Bath collection that was donated by Marion Jennings Waring, who was the daughter of Andrew Jackson Waring, who was one of the attorneys that worked on the Borden case, and certainly he had been Andrew Borden's personal attorney. So that was a major collection, and items have been donated from that point on, and there have been a number of important collections that have come into the Society. Before that, there were small items. photographs and different things that might have belonged to Lizzie. But the largest collection, certainly up until the 1960s, would have been the so-called Hip Death Collection.
I was talking to Dr. Stephanie Corey last week about the historic fires of Fall River, and she talked about the Great Fire of 1928. And she said that, this is based on her research and her book, that the Fall River Historical Society in 1928 suffered a lot of property loss in that fire. Would there have been any important historical artifacts or documents that would have been lost in that fire?
Well, the society at that point did not have an actual building. The society was in two rented rooms at the Buffington Building, which was a supposedly fireproof building, which is still standing, and it was owned by a member of the Historical Society. So the building burned, and the society lost everything in its collection, excepting some items in a safe that survived the fire, so some manuscripts. And we do have records of the early acquisitions. So although there were some interesting things and I think some fairly important things, nothing pertaining to the Borden case at all, certainly in the 1920s, and I think up until the time of Lizzie Borden's death, no one would have even dared venture to give anything to the Historical Society pertaining to Lizzie Borden. It simply was not discussed, nor would it have been collected, you know, by the Historical Society at that time.
So the Hip Bath collection was donated after that fire?
Oh, long after, yes. That was donated in the 1960s.
It was roughly at 1967.
Oh, that late?
Yes. Andrew Jennings' daughter and son had the material, and it really was in their father's home, and after he passed, years later, they were cleaning out the house and found the items. And when it became public that she had them, she, I think, basically got tired of people asking to see them, and so she donated them to the Historical Society, I think, simply to get rid of them.
Dennis, could you describe what was in that Hip Bath collection and why it's significant?
Well, it's a collection of materials that pertain to the trial. There are several photographs that were trial exhibits. There's transcript of the preliminary hearing, transcripts of the inquest, transcripts of the witness statements that were taken by the police in the days following the murder. Jennings' journals have come in later. They were not part of the Hip Bath collection, but they have since come in, but then they were his property and had to do with notes that were taken upon interviewing various people that were somehow connected to the story.
And Andrew Jennings was Lizzie Borden's defense attorney.
Yes, he was the family lawyer, and before she hired George Dexter Robinson to represent her and head the defense team, Andrew Jennings was probably the main character as far as her defense was concerned.
And Robinson was an ex-governor of Massachusetts?
Yes.
So that was really what they called the dream team of 1893?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, so that was Jennings' Hip Bath?
Yes.
The Hip Bath was a collection of different documents, but is there an official published collection of what was in there?
Yes. Actually, if one goes to the Historical Society's website and goes to the Lizzie Borden section, and there will be a drop-down that details the named Lizzie Borden collections and the Hip Bath collection, there's a complete inventory of everything in that collection on our website.
This might sound weird, but the Hip Bath itself, the physical Hip Bath, is that still around?
No. It just happened that when Jennings brought these things home, and the collection also includes any extant evidence, he stored them in an old Hip Bath, and that's where they were found by his children. And we do have a Hip Bath in the collection, but not the Hip Bath.
So you two are the co-authors of Parallel Lives. This is not the first publication that the Fall River Historical Society has done. What other publications before this have you published?
Well, in 1994, Michael and I co-edited The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lizzie A. Borden, the Knowlton Papers, 1892 to 1893. And those were papers, a collection of roughly 350-some documents, manuscripts, note letters that were the property of Jose Amaro Knowlton, who was the district attorney and the head of the prosecution in that trial. The society was given the collection by Knowlton's grandson, and we pulled it together, edited the letters, published them in chronological order so that you could really get a sense of how the story evolved, at least as far as the prosecution side of the case was concerned. And it's very interesting that a narrative thread does follow through as you read the letters, even though that they're all, you know, authored by various individuals, there is a constant, a narrative thread that does follow through to the end. And they're very fascinating, and some of the information is surprising in some ways when you actually read about the people that had no contact whatsoever with any of the individuals, but just felt that they had to express their opinion in one way or another.
And this book is out of print at the moment?
Yes, it is.
The collection was, you know, its publication was really unprecedented because this was the first major collection, in fact, the first collection of primary source material to ever appear in print. And it was also a massive collection in excess of 300 documents. So, and the existence of that collection was really pretty much unknown until they were donated to the Historical Society. And then just a few weeks after the story broke that these documents had been donated, the heirs of Rufus Bassett Hilliard, who was city marshal at the time, donated his collection of documents, which is a collection we're still working on. So it's amazing the amount of material that managed to survive and had never really been made accessible.
Yeah, there used to be a copy of the Knowlton papers lying around the B&B for guests to look at. I think it's since gone missing.
Probably. The book is out of print, and you know, it does command a fairly decent price on the secondary market. So at some point, we probably should reprint it. But there is a complete inventory of the Knowlton papers on the Society's website as well.
So Parallel Lives, how did this come about? When did you first get the idea for it, and what was your original intention for it?
Well, I think the intent was simply to write a little book, and initially we thought it would be a little that would just sort of tell Lizzie's story against the backdrop of the city in which she lived her life, which is a pretty basic concept, but not anything that had ever been attempted. And we knew going into it that we would have access to material in private collections that had not been made public, simply because it was a book that we were working on for the Historical Society and knew where to look for the material. But then it sort of morphed into this big book.
It took on a life of its own, pretty much.
The years sort of progressed. It ended up being a decade-long project.
So it started about 2001?
Thereabouts.
Roughly, yeah.
You know, thereabouts. Remember that there were only a handful of letters in Lizzie's hand known, and only a few photographs, and we managed to publish or uncover, I think, over 50 additional letters and, you know, a number of photographs. So it's just sort of amazing, you know, where the material turned up and the significance of the material that turned up. And I think it just made good sense to tell her story against the backdrop of the city. So I don't know if it was Kirkus or who it was that said it sort of was the first true biography of Lizzie Borden. And I think in some ways it actually was or is.
I believe so, because most of the books that came out previously, at least the popular ones, were true crime books.
Of course. They had to be, because no one knew anything about her personal life. So most of the Lizzie Borden books would be unchaptered. It would be everything from, you know, the Borden story up until the murders. The whole book would be about the murders and the trial. And then there'd be a few pages at the end about Lizzie's later life, because no one simply knew anything. And it was, you know, pretty easy to make up whatever you wanted to, because there weren't many people that could dispute it, since no one knew anything about it anyway. So it was amazing. I think that we were able to gain such insight into what her life was like. And of course, some of the interviews, I mean, there was one person who had never been interviewed who is the last person who knew Lizzie Borden. And she had some fascinating stories. So I think fairly important work.
No, I think when you look at the material that we uncovered, a huge portion of that material deals with her life after the acquittal. And that's the period that was a gray area before. And if you look at the book itself, it's not a chronological story at the beginning. It doesn't turn chronological until chapter 11. And that's just a little over halfway through the book. And the rest of it is about Lizzie's later life. And as I said, a tremendous amount of material surfaced, having to do with her life at Maplecroft and what she did and how she spent her time and how she felt. So much correspondence has surfaced from that period that really gives us a very clear look at Lizzie's mindset during that period.
Yeah, I was talking to Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, a couple of weeks ago, and she said that, I said, there's hardly anything about the Maplecroft years in your book. And she said that wasn't her choice. It was the choice of the publisher. 90% of the book is going to be the crime, and then maybe a hasty chapter at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of a standard format.
And it was also a children's book, teen reading level.
Yeah, I believe it's 10.
Yeah, 10 and up, I think, is what the dust jacket says.
Yeah, which is why there's no crime scene photos or anything like that. But the Maplecroft years are something that, because of your book, and now hopefully because of the restoration of Maplecroft by the current owner, this is a period of Lizzie's life that is opening up.
Well, it's an important period of her life, because she lived the greater portion of her life after the events of August 4th, 1892. So she lived the greater portion of her life sort of relentlessly hindered by this specter of suspicion. So that's a fascinating period. I mean, to be frank, I mean, we really know very little about the family before the events of August 4th, 1892. And we did, you know, gain some insight through Parallel Lives because of a collection of diaries that surfaced that were written by a very close friend of Lizzie's. So they would be, you know, covering the period when Lizzie was 14, 15, 16 years old. So that gave us some insight into her life at that period. But the truth of the matter is we actually know very little about lives of any of these people before the events of August 4th, 1892. So with Lizzie, by focusing on her later life, you do gain some insight into what she was like as a person and, you know, what other people thought of her. So, you know, I think one of the things people need to realize is that so much of what has been published is based on legend and innuendos and outright lies. And, you know, when you actually try to document some of these outlandish stories, it's next to impossible to do. I mean, the reality of the situation is that Lizzie was either guilty or was innocent, and we're never going to know one way or the other. And if she was guilty, then her difficult life was perhaps atonement for her sins. But if she was innocent, then, you know, in her life, you're going to find the makings of an epic tragedy. So really, you can look at this so many different ways.
Picking up on what Dennis said, the depth of material at Maplecroft years are really pretty extensive.
It was groundbreaking, I think, looking back at it, you know, looking back at it now. So,
is this because you had access more to, I mean, memories were fresher? It was a period of life that's closer to our time than the 1870s?
You know, I think in some ways, I think it had more to do with the fact that the descendants of people who knew her, and yes, certainly, because it was more recent in time. But the descendants of the people who knew her, barring the one person still, you know, living who knew her, but the descendants of the people who knew her had significant items in their collections that they had never made public, nor did they ever try to gain financially through the sale of these items, because they obviously have significant historical value, but they would have significant intrinsic value as well. So they never tried to cash in any way, but nor did they make the material available to researchers for a couple of reasons. One is that they had never been approached in most cases because people simply didn't know who they were. And then secondly, these people are still protecting the memory of a woman who they never knew. To them, it's almost a sacred trust because they're completely disgusted and disillusioned with the way Lizzie Borden's story has been handled. I'll tell you, we went into homes where sitting on the shelves were books of note by authors of note, authors who might be respected by other people in sort of the Lizzie Borden realm. And they were full of annotations and papers and notes pointing out all the inaccuracies. And these people had the documents to prove it. So many of these people, I have to say, are absolutely disgusted by the film and the many of the books and the way she's been portrayed.
Yeah.
So as such, they are very reluctant to make the material available. In the case of Parallel Lives, I think they knew that there was no hidden agenda. They knew that the book was being published by a nonprofit organization. I don't own the book. Dennis doesn't own the book. The Historical Society does. So if any money is ever made, it would be made by a nonprofit. So knowing that, they were much more agreeable to make their material public. And in some cases, I don't think they realized the extent of what they had. And then in other cases, they did know the extent, but they were very cautious with us at first before they actually made some more important material available.
So these relationships you had to build over many, many years. And Michael, even in your case, you said that some of these relationships predated your work on the book.
Oh, by far, by years. One doesn't simply pick up the phone and call someone looking for information. There are ways to do it, and there's a certain decorum that has to be followed, and, you know, one has to be very cautious. So in our case, that cautiousness paid off.
And Dennis, you and Michael have courted these relationships together.
Yes.
You've been heavily involved in meeting with these people, gaining their trust enough to release material, some of whom have chosen to remain anonymous.
Yes. It was really fascinating to, I think, both of us, that the loyalty that these people have developed, as Michael said, for someone they never knew, based on the love and respect that their ancestors had for Lizzie. And just in talking to these people and getting to know them, and in some cases going from talking to someone that was extremely reluctant to participate, and over time becoming very agreeable to the point of coordinating with their family to gather together things that might help us in telling the story of Lizzie. I mean, all of this support was tremendous. I think it's fascinating. One thing that we just had to laugh was that we found out how friendly and wonderful the people in Nova Scotia are, because part of our story had to do with Nova Scotia, and we had run an ad in the Nova Scotia paper, and based on that ad, we were looking for material on Lizzie's physician, her personal physician. And we had people that were calling their cousins. We got phone calls from Montreal. they just jumped on the bandwagon and were so tremendously helpful, crawling with anecdotes. I mean, you just found out how many people were really willing to be helpful and to put in their contributions. It was great.
You mentioned that many people chose to remain anonymous, and that's one thing that the Historical Society, we guarantee complete confidence. So although everything is cited, if a person chooses to remain anonymous, they know full well that when it comes to the Historical Society, we're very cautious about making people's identity known, and we only do that if they want it done. So that's important. I mean, the Lizzie Borden world is sort of a small world, and one has to be very, very cautious. Many of these people are very private, and they don't want to be contacted. And certainly in some cases, there have been attempts, and in some cases still are attempts, and they can kind of close up like a proverbial clam. They're very, very cautious for good reason. And certainly not all of the people that we were in touch with were ready yet to make their material available. There are some people who are not yet ready to do that, and I can understand it, and I can respect them for it. And so when the time comes, if it ever comes, so be it. And if it doesn't, that's their prerogative, and that's okay too.
I think that one thing that people really appreciated, and we were very firm on making the book as accurate as possible, was that when we finished sections based on information that certain individuals had given us, we had them fact check it for us and made sure that our quotes were accurate and our information was accurate, because it's very easy to, you know, accidentally misquote, or, you know, just one typographical error can change somebody's age or whatever.
Sure.
And these people were all extremely helpful in making sure that we were communicating the correct information.
And of course, for them, it was a very personal thing in many instances. You know, they wanted to be sure that it was accurate as far as they knew. When we talked to people all over the world, I mean, it was amazing. You know, one of the mistakes that people have made in the past is, of course, when they're trying to build Lizzie's circle, when they're trying to find out what Lizzie's world was like, what do? They go to her will and say, okay, let's try to track down the people who she mentioned in her will. Well, that's simple enough. I mean, that's child's play. But what one really has to do is find out who her closest friends were, and that doesn't mean they were mentioned in her will. There were addendums to wills, and, you know, Lizzie helped a lot of people and had a lot of friends and clearly lived a great many years after 1892. So the detective work was really sort of ferreting out who these people were and where they were, and we found their descendants all over the world. They're in Europe and Asia and South America. They were in Peru. They were in Peru, for God's sakes. And believe me, research in Peru is not easy. You know, we were fortunate. I mean, we had very close connections in Washington, so we had entree to a number of ambassadors who saw to it that their embassies opened up and did some work for us as well. So, again, it's just having enough connections and knowing enough people in the right places that can sort of expedite things. So we had a couple of ambassadors that we worked very closely with, and that helps considerably when you're trying to track down people in foreign countries. But the amazing thing is we were getting stories from people who did not know each other, who were telling us the same stories about Lizzie Borden. These people could not have been making this up. They simply did not know each other. And then they had the photographs and the documents to back it up, which is amazing.
Case in point is the fact that children of any number of Lizzie's friends referred to her as Auntie Borden. That's not something you can make up. It really isn't. And when you're hearing that from someone that wasn't prompted by either Michael or me to say, oh, by the way, so-and-so referred to Lizzie as Auntie Borden, and then talk to someone on the other side of the country, and they say, oh, by the way, children of, you know, my great aunt called her Auntie Borden. The stories were consistent and all coming from strangers, people that were strangers to each other.
And then the documents surfaced that assigned Auntie Borden the pattern of china that she gave little girls, bonnet babies patterned by royal bavers. We found pieces in collections all over the place with the same stories that they had been given to these people by Auntie Borden, and it's consistent. She did it with little girls. The pattern she gave to little boys. In many cases, their descendants still have some of these pieces. So there's a whole other side to the story. And little things, I mean, looking at letters and cards and things become apparent. For example, the fact that Lizzie had to be so unbelievably cautious in everything she did because her life was so closely scrutinized. When you're looking at her correspondence, and when we first looked at, you know, quite a bit of unpublished material, you realize that, for example, she was unable to send a postcard the way, you know, you or I might. She couldn't write a note on a postcard and put a stamp on it and drop it in a box. Lizzie wrote out her postcards, but she had to enclose them in envelopes and address the envelope because she knew people would be interested in her and would perhaps read her mail. So everything she did, she had to cover herself. She had to be extremely, extremely cautious. And she certainly was very cautious as to who she let in. And she expected, I think, demanded loyalty. And certainly the people who she let in, their descendants who never knew her are still maintaining that loyalty, and that is absolutely remarkable.
Now, the stories about her being anti-Borden to many, many children, this is in very stark contrast to sort of that Victoria Lincoln image of children seeing the scary woman on the hill.
Of course, but Victoria Lincoln, you have to remember, was an author, but a novelist. Victoria Lincoln, you know, was a pleasant enough lady, but she, I always said, and I'll say till the day I die, that I think she was a traitor to her class by writing that book. She should have known better. That being said, she painted an interesting picture of Fall River at the time, but she made an awful lot of it up. She was a novelist. And so she, if, you know, if there wasn't quite enough evidence, she sort of elaborated and made it up, and no one questioned it. But that being said, I think the title is perfect. It was a private disgrace. It was nobody's business. That's how local society thought of it. So she hit the nail on the head with the title. But I think the rest of the book, there's quite a bit of fluff there. But then there are some really good parts, you know, as well. But it's an interesting enough book. I mean, is it a major contribution? I don't think so. But at the time, it was more than anybody else knew. But certainly she elaborated, I mean, on the Nancy O'Neill relationship and the parties and the potted palms and the orchestras and all this business.
And the epilepsy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, Lizzie's life was so closely scrutinized from the events of August 4th on that if she had these epileptic episodes, it's just remarkable to me that apparently there was never another one for the rest of her life. But it made for a good story.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I read it 20 years ago, and it was a fascinating read. And because she had lived there, it seemed to have authority. I don't know. I saw the epilepsy as just another theory, but
other parts
of it I look back on now, and I can clearly see the imagination at work.
Right. And she knew that life. I mean, her family, the Lincoln family, had, although somewhat progressive, had been well-connected. So she certainly grew up, you know, on the Hill, and her family did. And she knew a lot of the right people and knew people to talk to. And so it was an interesting book. But certainly, there were enough people living at the time that they could have given her considerably more information than she was able to obtain, simply because it wasn't discussed at the time. And she didn't make any friends in Fall River when she published it, I can tell you that.
Sure. So how do we strike that balance between writing a book that really does its historical due diligence and also does not offend or maintain the integrity and the privacy of individuals and families? It seems to be a very hard balance to achieve.
Well, I think it is because, you know, you're talking about this brutal, heinous crime. And, I mean, Lizzie was tried and she was acquitted. And, you know, whether or not she was innocent or guilty is left to speculation. But I think one has to be very cautious because it is such a horrific sort of crime. Now, certainly years have passed. And although it is still very personal for some families, and it will remain that way into the next generation, I think, for certain families, and I certainly hope that it will, there are very few people left who had any close connection to Lizzie. So, unfortunately, though, people still seem to believe that whatever they see in documentary or whatever they read or whatever they see on film is real. They think it's the actual stories. So it makes it difficult to sort of tell the real story as far as we know. But then again, I mean, there has to be some speculation there simply because no one knows what actually happened, nor do I think they ever will.
I think that in working on Parallel Lives, the decision that Michael and I had from the very start was that if we wanted to write a book that did justice to the people involved in the story, then the first thing we had to do was to start off with a clean slate and not be opinionated and not have an opinion of Lizzie's innocence or guilt, but mainly to just tell the story through a clear lens and be fair. And with that as a starting point, then it became easier and easier to transfer the information that we obtained from people into the written word.
You know, we tried as much as possible to start off by dispelling as many of the myths as we possibly could, almost from the beginning. So what, for example, well, Andrew Borden's wealth. I mean, he's been made out to be one of the wealthiest men in the city and a leading citizen and extremely powerful, and none of this is true. I mean, Andrew Borden was an upper-middle-class businessman with a maybe $250,000 to $300,000 fortune, which was a substantial fortune in those days. Certainly, you could live very comfortably on the income from that money with a nice house and a staff and pretty much anything you wanted. But in a city like Fall River, I mean, these people were not even received socially. Fall River was a city of millionaires. It was a city of extremely prominent individuals, the largest producers of cloth in the world. And so Andrew Borden was really almost an insignificant businessman. There were lots of businessmen in Fall River with $300,000. That wasn't enough, certainly, to make him powerful by any means. And I think that if not for the events of August 1892, this family would have passed into obscurity, as did many others, because the truth of the matter is there's absolutely nothing interesting at all about Lizzie Borden's life, except that she was involved in this crime. And that's what makes it interesting. If not for the crime, I mean, she would have been one of a plethora of Yankee old maids in a city that was a powerful textile center. And that would have been the end of the story. I mean, her name would be nothing more than a name on a tombstone in Oak Grove Cemetery. So we tried to dispel the myth of his wealth and simple things like the house and the living conditions in the house, where we know it had a flush toilet in the basement. We know it had a central heating system. We know it had running water. So it wasn't as primitive as one has been led to believe. The story of the spoiled food the family had been eating. We know from the trial testimony what Bridget Sullivan prepared from a meal, and this joint of mutton did not appear at every meal. So, but all of these things make it easier to make Andrew Borden a character that you almost want to see someone take out. If you can make them all into villains, it just makes Lizzie that much more sympathetic.
Yeah, also the pigeons, the story about...
The pigeon.
Lizzie and the pigeons. That was something that, according to the urban legends, and the Lizzie is a serial killer cottage industry that's grown up.
Of course.
That story has been amplified and distorted.
Right, and we you know, try to make it a point of using... you know, trial testimony and the fact that there were lots of, you know, as we said in Parallel Lives, I think it was nothing more than squab. I mean, it was just pigeons in the kitchen because they were going to eat them. I mean, it was, but then again, when you think of this maniacal Andrew Borden with a hatchet killing Lizzie Borden's pigeons, it makes for a great scene in a film, but other than that, it doesn't do much.
Well, did he snapped their necks, though. He didn't really use a hatchet.
Well, apparently, but you know, if you purchased squab, they were purchased live, and did he snap the necks or did somebody else's? I mean, she said that she thought her father, you know, wrung their necks, I think is how she put them, and that they were very tender and some twisted off. I'm sure you've probably had squab. It's really very nice, and, you know, you buy it fresh, and you wring their little necks and pluck them and have them for dinner. And I think that's basically all it was. When you read Lizzie's testimony, clearly she was not distraught about slaughter of her pet pigeons. It was almost inconsequential to her.
Yeah, well, everyone has, at least people of my generation, have that image of Elizabeth Montgomery standing there going, "They were my pigeons, my pigeons.
Of course. And that's what happens. I mean, people, you know, in the same film, you know, I think Abby Borden or someone opens a tureen of some sort of moldering stew and an insect comes out of it, a fly.
Yeah, you hear a fly buzzing on the soundtrack.
Exactly. So that's the story, you know, and that's what people believe. But I personally don't think Andrew Borden deprived his daughters of much of anything, actually.
That comes out in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't think that he did. And the Borden sisters were very well dressed. And I've heard people say, well, you know, he gave them, I don't remember what the allowance was, but it was an insignificant sum. Well, certainly they would not have had to have used their allowance for clothing and things. For all of the girls in her set of that class, the dressmaker would come and father would pay the bills. I mean, one always charged their clothing to their father. That's simply how it was done. And there's no reason to believe that it wasn't done that way in the Borden household. You know, again, it's difficult to document so many of these things. Unfortunately, Andrew Borden's financial records did not survive, apparently. So, you know, we don't know what he was paying to dressmakers, but clearly someone was paying the bills, and those girls were well-dressed, and we now know they were free to come and go as they pleased, and I question how suppressed their lives actually were. And then we tried to compare their lives to the lives of some of their contemporaries. And let's face it, I mean, Lizzie and Emma traveled in circles where the majority of the women were daughters of ministers or old maid school teachers, and some of those girls had to work for a living. And Lizzie and Emma certainly never had to do that. So I question if their lives were as difficult as one sort of likes to believe.
There are two examples of Andrew Borden's character that I think unquestionably tell you what type of person he was, or at least how he provided for his family. The first one is that he becomes the guilty character in giving property to Abby Borden, being the house on 4th Street, when actually he was doing the right thing and he was trying to help out his sister-in-law. The other thing is that, and this is so obvious and nobody ever recognizes it, there were three adult women in that household, none of whom were employed, and he had hired a full-time domestic who lived in. She did the dishes, she did windows, we know that. But according to her testimony at the trial, I mean, her workload was not all that heavy. One response to what her responsibilities around the house were was that every other Friday morning, she swept the front hall. Now, I mean, that's not a rigorous work schedule.
You know, we are still working on and have yet to publish the Jennings journals, but those are going to be very revealing in that Jennings interviewed people who he knew. So I think that perhaps when they were talking to him, they were much more
forthcoming
because they knew him. They were comfortable with him. And some of the stories are interesting as far as Andrew Borden goes. You know, so we do know that yes, he was planning a move. I mean, no question he had been looking at property. You know, we do know he always referred, when talking to people, he always referred to his daughters as my girls. And there are stories about how Andrew Borden would, Borden's sisters were away, they would write to their father, and he would carry these letters around in his pocket and would read them to people who asked about his daughters. So there was a different dynamic there. Clearly something went wrong. There's no question. I mean, there are two sides to every story. We all know that. But the relationship clearly is very different than the relationship that has sort of descended through history, which is based on old newspaper accounts and absolutely no documentation at all. I mean, that's the important thing to realize it. You know, we tried to document some of these really outlandish stories about, you know, Lizzie chopping the head off Abby's cat.
Oh, because she wanted to have a funeral.
And all of these crazy stories. And you can trace them all back to newspapers.
You can trace a lot of them back to the Knowlton papers, actually.
Exactly. Because the people who were writing to Knowlton were writing from all over the country with these sort of outlandish theories. Or they'd write a letter and say, a friend of mine who knew a cousin of Lizzie's mother remembered that in Swansea, when Lizzie was a little girl, she broke the neck on a robin because she wanted to have a funeral. And so then these things sort of get republished, and then they become fact. But, I mean, if Lizzie Borden was going around chopping off the head of Abby's kittens and wringing the necks of robins and stealing things all over town, they had places for women like that. And they were called insane asylums, and it was easy to put women there. And certainly in the 19th century, that's what one did. And I don't think that Andrew Borden would have had any reason, you know, but to follow suit and do what all his contemporaries did. So this sort of crazed Lizzie Borden running around town, I think, is a bit off.
When we were doing the research for Parallel Lives, we got to a point where we came to find out that the Lizzie Borden that history had handed us was a fictional character, pretty much all the way around. Every time we thought there was something that we knew was true about Lizzie Borden, we'd find several things to dispel the point that she was not at all the person that Lizzie Borden was before Parallel Lives.
Okay, we're going to take a break now. This is the Lizzie Borden Podcast, and we're talking to Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett, the co-curators of the Fall River Historical Society, located at 451 Rock Street in Fall River, Massachusetts. Information about the society could be found on their Facebook page or on their website, lizzieborden.org.
Nine Muses Books is proud to sponsor the Lizzie Borden Podcast. Nine Muses Books is an independent press featuring the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series written by author Richard Behrens. These well-crafted comic mysteries set a fictionalized Lizzie as a teenage detective against a real Victorian-era Fall River, Massachusetts. The characters are remarkably vivid, the narrative is intellectually stimulating, and as one critic has described it, author Richard Behrens really knows how to toss delightfully deceptive literary curveballs that keep the reader mystified until just that penultimate perfect moment. Michael Martins of the Fall River Historical Society has called these stories a must-read for all those intrigued by Fall River history, mystery, and of course, Lizzie Borden. Shelley Dezik of the Lizzie Borden Warps and Wefts blog has written that the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective series are so much fun, it's nearly criminal. The Lizzie Borden Girl Detective mysteries can be found on Amazon in ebook format, and most books are offered as free downloads. In addition to these short stories, there is also the full-length novel The Minuscule Monk, offered in both print book and ebook formats. For more information, go to lizziebordengirldetective.com and sign up for our newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and listen to our podcasts on iTunes. Visit the Garden Bay Films channel on YouTube to see special visual editions of our podcasts, as well as the Lizzie mini-series. And now, back to the Lizzie Borden Podcast.
We're talking to the curators of the Fall River Historical Society, Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett, also co-authors of the groundbreaking book Parallel Lives, The Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River. It seems as if previous attempts to describe Lizzie and create a character of Lizzie is more being that most of the books were true crime books. The authors would come in with no credentials, no connection to the area, or even if they did, I mean, it didn't matter. They would come in for X number of weeks and question who they could without courting the relationships that you guys did for years, getting stuff from previous books that had similar fake stories and urban legends in them and propagating those. You were the first to really craft a a Lizzie Borden as a character that's more in alignment with the process of doing history.
It was the material that we uncovered that told the story. I mean, so much of it, you know, is told through Lizzie's writings, through her letters and the notes and the cards. And just some of it was, I think, just looking at the story with just common sense. And so much of what we were able to do with her later life was simply looking at what she was saying and looking at the letters and dissecting them and figuring out what she was talking about and then following those avenues to find out who these people were and what their connection to her was. And that would lead us into different directions. And that's why this damn thing took 10 years. I mean, it just kept going because we kept following fictional leads. And I'll tell you, there were some cases where we had spent considerable time, and in one instance years, looking for a particular family and dropped it. And so we had this file of sort of dead ends. And toward, like I thought we were toward the end of the book, we looked at the file and decided to make a last attempt with these people. And we were successful on every one of them. And the stuff that turned up was amazing. I think Dennis tells a story about 1 week, was it, Dennis?
It was a little over 2 weeks where every single day when we'd come into work, we'd be working on the book, and either the phone would ring, we'd get an email, or someone would call down from the museum shop upstairs and say, there's someone here that wants to see you, has a story to tell you about Lizzie Borden. I mean, it was at a point where, I mean, you started to twitch a little bit every time the phone rang because you never quite knew what to expect.
You know, the funny thing about that was that every one of these items, every one of these things he saw led to significant finds that in themselves would have been, you know, a major article, or certainly the AP would have picked up the story, or, you know, whatever. So it was just sort of funny that this stuff turned up the way it did. So we just let her writings. I mean, the prison letters, for example, extremely, extremely poignant letters. I think the most significant that have ever surfaced. And she was always painted as a sort of cold, stoic individual who showed no emotion. And you have to remember, of course, that the newspaper reporters who were writing about her, they never interviewed her. They didn't know her. They didn't know anything about her. And the people who knew her best didn't talk. So they were talking to people who really didn't know her. And then you read the prison letters that were never intended to be made publicly. And, you know, she says things like, think soon they can take me up the road to the insane asylum at Taunton Mental Hospital. You know, I see no ray of light amidst the gloom. And clearly she was grieving, and clearly she was on trial for her life, and she was utterly hopeless, and she was having a very difficult time of it. And these letters were never intended to be published. I mean, she was sending them to a very close friend, a woman she'd known since childhood. She, you know, there's a considerable outpouring there, and these were amazing, amazing letters, so that they shed light into what her life was like in prison. So it is amazing, I think, some of the stuff that turned up.
Those were on display. I remember seeing some of those.
They were temporarily. They're not currently, but they are in the archival collection. I think the Society is certainly the central repository from material pertaining to this case. So there's a significant amount of material here. And still, you know, there's still items that are coming into the Society. And as I said, there are still very important things in private collections that ultimately, I think, will be made public. And when they do, will be very revealing. So, or interesting, if not revealing. So, and when that time comes, then, you know, we'll go with it. But until then, we just sort of, and even after Parallel Lives, material came in after the fact. It was too late to put into Parallel Lives, so we'll do something with that.
You know, it's interesting that not only the content of the letters that have come into our collection, but just sometimes the letters themselves speak volumes about Lizzie Borden's character. One particular case is a collection of cards and letters that were sent to one particular family, two little girls and their mother. And the birthday cards that were sent to the little girls, every single one of them was delivered special delivery with postage paid by the sender. Just that fact that she thought that these little girls were special enough so that the mailman would go special delivery, and when that doorbell rang, it wasn't all the mail for the whole family. It was a birthday card for her.
Yeah, the book is filled with revelation after revelation. You guys have been involved in it on a very personal level, on a very deep level for years. For those of us who have only relied upon published material to gain access to new stuff about Lizzie Borden, the book was an avalanche.
It was a lot, yeah.
Yeah, you're turning page after page. It was so tempting to just skip everything and go right. First thing I did when I got the book is I looked at all the photographs.
Exactly.
You know, like if there's new photographs of Lizzie, I don't want to wait till I'm on page 1,000 to see the real.
And there were. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, there were, you know, new photographs. And it's funny, for some people, I think the Holy Grail, we would always say the Holy Grail would be sort of candid photographs, just snapshots of Lizzie Borden. And we found them, you know. There still is, and I'll be quite frank in telling you that there still is significant photographic material out there in a couple of private collections.
I mean, I know that it's really not carved in stone anywhere that they have to come out. that they have to be published. Photographs about Lizzie Borden, however, do serve more about establishing her as a person.
Yes.
Any hope that soon any more will come out?
Well, I have no way of knowing that at all. I mean, the people that have some of these things may someday decide to make them public if the time is right for them. And until that time, we just sort of wait.
Sure.
Some, you know, we've had access to, we've seen them, but they're not the Historical Society's property. So, you know, we don't have the possibility of publishing them in any way. And that's okay. I mean, when the time comes, there is a very, very significant collection of letters out there. It will be when it surfaces, if it surfaces, the largest collection of Lizzie's correspondence to have ever surfaced. And these are in a private collection and I think are significant. So when the time's right, perhaps, you know, they'll be made public by the family that has them, or they'll be, you know, donated to the Historical Society, or they'll allow us to publish them. But until that time, you know, they have no connection to the Historical Society. I mean, we're aware of them, but then that's okay. That's okay. When they're ready, then maybe something will be done about it.
Well, with all due respect, you've seen them, so you could have that attitude.
Well, no, I haven't, actually. I've seen them, but I actually had the opportunity to read them and chose not to.
Oh, you're talking about the letters.
The letters. Yeah, I had the opportunity to read some of them, and I chose not to simply because family is not ready to make them public, and I didn't want to read anything that I might slip and make public. So it was almost a moot point. I mean, it made no sense for me to look at them, but they're there. I've seen them. I know they're there. So, and then one never knows where the material is as well. I mean, there are things that have turned up that we had no idea they existed. There's one gentleman, the really wonderful photograph of Lizzie
on
the piazza there at Mapletroff. And that came from, what was it, New Mexico?
Yeah.
You know, and he didn't even know he had it. So it's just amazing how some of the stuff turned up. And he was another one that we tracked down through this sort of for really convoluted path all over the country, and then found him, and he sent us some material. And in the material he sent us was this photograph of this unknown woman.
This is the person that I had, Michael had spoken with him, and I had to call him back to try to get some more information from him. And I had a list of questions to ask him. And in the course of our conversation, he started telling me things, and he was answering the questions before I had even asked them. And he, in turn, ended up sending some material out. And just as an example as to how dazed sometimes we were, I was looking at these photographs, and I pulled this one up, and I said, that's not his grandmother. And I said, who the hell is that? And so I showed Michael the picture, and he said, oh, my God. And he said, that's the stone chimney on the piazza at Maplecroft. And
yeah.
He said, that's Lizzie Borden. Look at her. And, I mean, she had the same hair for almost her entire life, the same style of hair. And there she is sitting there with a Boston Terrier, of all things, in her lap.
But the dead giveaway there was the fact that the map on the photograph had been initialed in Lizzie's hand, and it was the initials of the woman she had sent it to. And then lo and behold, several months later, we were with another family, and they pulled out some photographs, and they had the identical photograph that had been sent to one of their family members.
And they were all excited to show it to us. And we said, oh, yeah, we've seen that.
We have a copy. That came from New Mexico, you know, So it's funny how the stuff turns up. I mean, recently the Society acquired the photograph of Blackie, Lizzie Borden's cat, and that, you know, came from the same source as Lizzie Borden's watch that had been left to someone in a will. And so things turn up. In fact, behind my desk is a breadboard, and this is a breadboard that came from Maplecroft. And how do we know it came from Maplecroft? Well, the family that donated it to the Historical Society had a family member who removed it from Maplecroft. The provenance is absolutely impeccable. So we're often offered lots of material that belonged to Lizzie Borden, and unless we can establish provenance beyond any shadow of a doubt, we will not accept these items into the collection. And that's the same thing with photographs. Before making a photograph public, we're always extremely, extremely careful, and in some cases, we'll wait until hopefully another image of the photograph shows up so that there's no doubt, you know, who that photograph is. You know, it's easy to say, oh, my grandmother said that this dish belonged to Lizzie Borden, especially when no one really questions it. But when you try to establish the provenance, you see that, you know, it's highly unlikely. So, but there are still a lot of her possessions out there.
And Emma's.
And there are people who have things that, you know, I'll tell you a funny story, and it just goes to show how, I guess, maybe lax I was in a lot of ways. It just never occurred to me. I can remember going to a woman's home who was, you know, a friend of Florence Brigham's, and went there fairly often. And she had a silver service that belonged to Lizzie to use, and she had some Oriental rugs, and she had a bunch of stuff that had belonged to Lizzie. And I knew it, and she said it, but it never occurred to me at the time to ask where she'd acquired them, because you didn't. I mean, you don't walk into someone's house and ask where they got that thing. So it never occurred to me. And it wasn't until years later, when we were working on Parallel Lives, that I made the connection and realized who she was in relationship to Lizzie Borden. And then it made so much sense as, you know, why she had these things. And of course, by that point, she had passed and her material had all been dispersed. So out there somewhere is probably the Lizzie Borden Silver Service. I'd know it if I saw it, but you know, who knows? So it's just funny how this, that definitely is material around. And there's a lot of it out there that people seem to believe belonged to Lizzie, and it simply didn't. I mean, it's complete fabrication. So,
well, in reading the book, I remember being struck by the scrapbooks that she kept of her grand tour, because not only are they her books, but they have her handwriting and her thoughts written on them.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And they're beautiful, two of them. Beautiful help.
Any chance that they will ever be reproduced? Because we only have a few pages of them in Parallel Lives.
I don't know. I don't know. The people that have them have significant material, and they're not particularly interested in the interest in Lizzie, and they're not interested really in people who are interested in Lizzie. They like thought of Parallel Lives because I think they thought that they were doing their part in trying to at least portray Lizzie as a human being as opposed to a legend, which is why they made their material, you know, available to us. But they were and are extremely cautious. So I don't know the answer to that question. I can tell you that there are two albums. They're magnificent albums. The photographs are beautiful. Again, as Dennis says, they say so much about Lizzie because of the precision with which she did everything. And the other thing is, it's very revealing because you talk about this sort of suppressed Lizzie Borden who didn't have much money and was really living on the shoestring provided by her father. These albums were the best she could procure at the time. They're deluxe albums, they're gilded, they're beautiful, they clearly were extremely expensive. The photographs that she had purchased abroad were not small, inexpensive images, so she clearly had funds at her disposal. The other thing, and I think the huge mistake that people make, is they'll say, well, you know, in the newspaper it says that Lizzie Borden was worth X number of dollars time of the trial. Believe me, if there's one thing that Yankee old maids, and certainly Yankee families, are very good at doing, is hiding their money. And it was much easier in the 19th century than it is today.
Yeah.
And I can assure you that Lizzie Borden had considerable wealth. She was not impoverished. Lizzie Borden could buy what she wanted and didn't have to think about it a whole lot. Case in point, we know now that one of the things that Lizzie did after she was suspect was she had Mary Ellis Sheen Brigham go up to her room, and she showed her, what was it, her stock certificates and bank books and things, and said, why would I have done it? So Andrew Borden would have provided in some way for his daughters. I mean, the fact that he didn't have a will, and those girls, I'm sure, were comfortable enough and had accounts that never made it into the newspapers of the day. The other mistake people make, too, is, you know, they look at what estates were probated at and say, well, this has to be the person's wealth, not by a long shot, because there were a number of Fall River families who, you know, might have had an estate probated at a few $100,000, and in fact, they had millions. So there were ways to get around these things. So I think that Lizzie Nemeth certainly had more. And clearly, by looking at the items that she had before 1892, she could buy, apparently, what she wanted. The house, you know, you talk about the fact that it wasn't a large home and it was maybe not terribly comfortable. You know, for a family of four with a maid living in the attic, it was a comfortable enough house. The arrangement of rooms, yes, might have been, you know, unusual. But we do know now that Andrew Borden was indeed looking for a house. And he actually had put an offer in on a house. And the family that had the house ultimately decided not to sell. So, you know, at some point, more of this information will be made available when we can finally publish the Jennings journals, which we're working on. But there's another side to the story. I think it's important that everything be documented. It's so easy to say things and then not document them. And we tried in Parallel Lives to cite sources for everything that we said. And that's not always easy to do.
Yeah, one of the triumphs of the book, I believe, is that your restraint, your discretion, your respect for the material, the dignity with which the material is presented, it strikes just the right note. I wouldn't be surprised at all to hear that the people that you work with are very pleased with it.
Well, they seem to be, certainly. In fact, there was one person that we spoke to, and to get to this individual, we had to go sort of a roundabout route. And when we spoke to this person, the first comment was, I was wondering when the Historical Society was going to do something about this. You know, it never would have occurred to this individual to contact the Historical Society. It simply isn't done that way. But when we were in touch, we were given access to material. And it was, again, another sort of side of the story. So, but if truth be told, I mean, I have to be completely honest in saying that that I think more material was uncovered than we realized we would uncover at the beginning. I mean, I didn't expect a good portion of what we found, and I think Dennis would agree.
Michael and I actually have spoken on Parallel Lives, and at the very beginning we had made a prototype of what we were thinking of as a book. It was kind of a horizontally oriented book that was maybe about an inch and a half thick, if that, and it was going to be a combination of text and photographs, and kind of like a small coffee table book. And when we speak, we bring it with us. And then we show the end result. And it's funny how things develop. But it wasn't all a piece of cake either. Some of the cultivating of relationships, in some cases, we sort of had to pass the third degree in proving that there was nothing in it for us. And we had questions that kind of put you on the spot, questions that there was some integrity to what we were trying to do. And fortunately, we passed muster on in all cases. So,
and you can see why people are cautious. You know, I can understand it. And I think one of the things I said to Dennis at the beginning, and one of the mistakes that I think a lot of people have made in the past is they read about Lizzie and they sort of look at Lizzie, but they don't. To understand Lizzie Borden, you have to have some sense of what life was like for an old maid Yankee lady in Fall River. And fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on the case, I had the fortune or misfortune of knowing a number of them. And if you think the way they thought, and if you have some sense as to how they lived their lives and why they did the things they did, things become so apparent that it makes it difficult to believe that no one's picked up on it in the past. So it's kind of an interesting way to look at things, I think. But to understand Lizzie, you have to look very closely at the world in which she lived her life, which is what we tried to do with Parallel Lives, and you have to have some sense of why she did many of the things that she did in her later life, because we don't know about her earlier life. But you have to look at why she did things the way she did, and that gives you a different insight. And fortunately, enough material has survived to substantiate some of those findings. So simple things, and then in some cases, very complicated things. I mean, fortunately, there were enough people still living when I was, when I was a kid that knew her, and I got to know some of them pretty well. And so there were some interesting stories there. And then the research that Dennis and I did, just sort of ferreting out these people. And some of it was tough work. I mean, it wasn't easy to find a lot of these people. I mean, in some cases, all we had was like fragmentary names to go by. So that's why it takes years.
I think the one name that was kind of like a giveaway was Hilma Erickson, because we went to the census and we figured, how many Hilmas can there be? Do you know how many Hilmas there are?
It's a much more common name than you might think. Oh, it's a very common Swedish name. We figured that's going to be a dead end there, so we had to take a different avenue on that one.
Is Wilma a Swedish name?
Hilma, H-I-L-M-A.
But there's also the name Wilma. I was just wondering if that's
Wilma, and in a census, they kind of look alike and whatever.
Because I'm wondering what nationality Wilma Flintstone was.
She looks British.
Yeah, she looks British, yeah. But that part of it, the sort of ferreting out some of this information, was really time. Don't ever spend a decade writing a book, I can tell you that.
She lived until 1927. Are there any movies of her? Anyone do any home movies?
I don't know that. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there were, but it would surprise me if there was. Possible. I know people have asked about a recording of her voice, and the funny thing is, I never thought really of asking anyone like Russell Lake, who lived across the street from Lizzie and who grew up in the shadow of Maplecroft. I mean, he was at her funeral, and he was born in the house across the street from Lizzie, and he knew her for the first 30-some years of his life. It wouldn't surprise me if someone like Russell Lake had a camera at that point, but maybe not. I mean, the footage of the 1928 fire, so that we know that there were members of the Brayton family and certain individuals involved with her who had movie equipment. So is there any reason that some of these other people didn't? I mean, it's probably more unlikely than anything, but who knows? Someone's asked about a recording of her voice as well, and that's not something that I've ever heard. And she was very cautious. I mean, I don't think she was, even in the snapshots, I mean, she never looked totally comfortable. So I think she might have died away from the movie camera. But
would be nice to see. Again, I'm speaking as someone who's on the outside waiting years for these tidbits to come out.
Yeah, it's always interesting when some new stuff, when new material surfaces. So
I'm sure there's always this conflict of trying to decide, like, how significant. You have all this trivial stuff. I mean, if you find a grocery list that she wrote that may be of some interest, but is that something that really needs to be announced and published?
No, I think anything like that that comes into the Historical Society's collection, you know, would make public.
Like a meatloaf recipe.
Right? But one of the things that we're doing with our new website is, you know, the Lizzie Borden section, the named collections, we're putting out complete inventories. Now, certainly we're not reproducing all the documents. I mean, that's next to impossible. People would still have to come in and do research, but at least there are complete inventories with a basic sort of synopsis of what is contained in some of the material, so that will help researchers.
Yeah.
And there is a section that we're working on that's not there yet, which will be various items in the collection pertaining to either Lizzie or Emma or the family or some of the sort of associated people. And what we do is we'll give people a brief description of what the item is, and then the provenance, because the Historical Society has to establish beyond the shadow of a doubt that the material in our collection is here because we have the provenance, and we're not speculating, we're not saying maybe this was hers. We're telling you that this is how it was acquired and this is the provenance, and, you know, it just makes good sense, because there is so much material out there that's being, you know, purported to have belonged to Lizzie, and it's just outlandish. And so you can't just simply buy something in an antique shop and say, oh, this has Lizzie Borden's name on it, so it had to have been hers. There's more to it. Now, certainly if a book shows up at auction and, you know, they've showed up on eBay and different things, her signature is very distinct. So that's, you know, that's simple enough. But even then, piece like that's acquired, you try to establish provenance and try to figure out how it ended up where it ended up. So, but there still is, you know, there still is material out there. So.
For a while, there were a lot of dubious items that actually had a certificate of authenticity that accompanied them. Right? Of course, it was something that was like just run off on a computer printer.
They were being produced locally, and of course, the certificate of authenticity didn't establish provenance. It simply said that the person who sold the piece saying it was real. And there were people who were foolish enough to buy into this.
So the blood-splattered mantelpiece clock that I bought on eBay for $4,000, I should just throw it out?
Yeah, you probably should have saved you $4,000.
Drat.
You know?
Drat.
Yeah, damn.
Oh, well.
But did it come with a certificate of authenticity?
Okay, Michael and Dennis, I want to thank you so much for sharing all this with us and for taking the time to talk to the Lizzie Borden podcast. And
thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have fun over your hiatus and have a wonderful holiday, New Year, and winter season. The best of luck to you.
Okay, that was good. Happy New Year, Richard.
That was our interview with the curators of the Fall River Historical Society, Michael Martins and Dennis Bennett, co-authors of the groundbreaking book, Parallel Lives, The Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River. I hope this has inspired you to check out the book and explore its vast amount of material on Lizzie Borden, the Borden murders of 1892, and the city of Fall River itself, as Lizzie would have known it during her lifetime. The book is available from the Historical Society and from Amazon.com. Join us next time on the Lizzie Borden Podcast with the premiere of a Lizzie Borden girl detective mystery radio drama, The Agitated Elocutionist. It's going to be a lot of fun. And check out LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com for more information about the upcoming book, The Audible Amnesiac, and other Lizzie Borden girl detective mysteries from Nine Muses Books. I'm your host, Richard Behrens, and I'll see you next time on the Lizzie Borden Podcast. This podcast was produced by Nine Muses Books and engineered by Mason Amadeus. The theme music was composed and performed by Melora Krieger. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is sponsored by Nine Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. More information can be found at LizzieBordenPodcast.com and LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com.